area
of the second
with Jennifer Williams, an aide to Vice President Mike Pence,
Committee,
Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman,
I'm Kat
a National Security Council aide, Kurt Volker,
a
former U.S. Special Envoy to Ukraine,
gavel-to-gavel,
and Tim Morrison, a National Security Council aide.
You are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Catskill, Acre, Hudson, Chatham, East Chatham, South Chatham, and North Cooksackie. Hands-on community radio.
And they are being
this is a special program scheduling announcement.
So it's going to begin with
local WGXC programming will be interrupted on 90.7 FM. This is a special program scheduling announcement.
And then later in the day,
local WGXC programming will be interrupted on 90.7 FM on Tuesday.
And that will be with Kurt Volker, who is the former United States Special Envoy to Ukraine, and then Timothy Morrison, who is with the National Security Council. So I'm expecting a long day. I went to sleep last night at 9:30, Kat.
to prepare for this one.
That's right.
I should have followed your lead, Mitch Jezerich. Let's talk a little bit about the people that we are going to hear from today, starting with Jennifer Williams, who we have heard less about to the point that you just made, an aide to Vice President Mike Pence, specifically on Europe, but on loan, really, from the State Department, not someone that went directly through their office, through the White House, which has sort of been the White House's response that, you know, she's not really one of us. She's on loan to us from the State Department, sort of doing what Donald Trump has done, you know, wiping their hands clean and saying, we don't even really know her, even though her testimony, well, you know, what we know about it hasn't been all that controversial. She hasn't taken a side. She said that she did think that what she heard, and it is important to note that she actually listened to the call that took place, that what she heard was irregular and, you know, she thought perhaps inappropriate, but it didn't cause any serious concern from her for her. She didn't go running to tell anyone about it, yet she's still receiving the ire of both Donald Trump and the White House.
Yeah, Donald Trump called her a never Trumper, and yesterday went at her on Twitter, which is interesting because we'll remember from Friday's hearing as Marie Yovanovitch is giving this really intense testimony about being at a ceremony honoring the life of an anti-corruption activist who was murdered through an acid attack and died a slow, painful death. While she's at that event, when she gets the call from the State Department saying, we fear for your security, get on the first place plane coming back to Washington, that's when Donald Trump basically attacked Marie Yovanovitch on Twitter. And Adam Schiff made a big deal of it and even said we take intimidation of witnesses quite seriously, made that moment even more significant because Donald Trump did that. So what happens yesterday, once again, it wasn't during the hearing, and we'll see. We'll have to monitor his Twitter feed today. But during the hearing, yesterday, he went after Jennifer Williams, who seems to be the most innocuous of all these people who are going to be testifying today. And as you indicated, she's with the State Department, but was serving as an aide to Mike Pence. Mike Pence had his own communications with Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine. In her closed deposition, she said she didn't believe that she didn't know of Mike Pence's involvement in this pressure campaign. So I suspect she'll probably say very similar things today. And then and again, as you said, she did think that that call was potentially inappropriate, but not damningly so. Not like Alexander Vindman, who also listened into the call, who will also be testifying at the side of Jennifer Williams this morning.
It will be interesting to see how the Republicans treat the witnesses today, particularly Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, someone who's received the Purple Heart for his service.
I think they're going to try to make him look like a partisan player in all of this. That seems that's what's being reported. The playbook of the Republicans on this hearing, Alexander Vindman, and later in the afternoon, and the second panel is going to be really interesting too with Tim Morrison and Kurt Volker. Alexander Vindman worked under Tim Morrison, and so they actually replaced Tim Morrison after Tim Morrison resigned. Tim Morrison, Alexander Vindman, their account of what happened doesn't necessarily differ, but their interpretation of what happened differs very much. And Tim Morrison has indicated that he didn't think that there was anything improper with the telephone call, at least between Trump and Zelensky, even though he was part of the process of removing it to a more secure server, taking it out of the regular computer server where they house these type of transcripts from calls with foreign leaders. The White House took that transcript out, the rough transcript out, and put it in a highly classified server so less people can get to it. What Tim Morrison says is that they were concerned that, first off, it was a mistake that the people who actually physically removed the transcript from one server and put it into another misunderstood the order. But secondly, they say, but we did want to make it less likely that people would have the ability to be able to see this, because in the hyper-political dynamics in Washington, D.C. today, if it got out there, they feared that it would then be used by Democrats and it would become a big issue, which of course it has.
And valid fear.
And what the reason they say that he was worried about that is because he was worried that it would send a message to Ukraine that there isn't the bipartisan support for that country that we've seen in the United States since it became an independent country in the early 1990s. So that's their claim of why they did it, was because they didn't want to affect the confidence that Ukraine had in the United States.
So when you say the Republicans are going to treat him like a partisan player, you mean like a Republican or like a Democrat?
Well, they will treat Alexander Vindman as somebody who opposes Donald Trump.
They have to be careful in the same way that they treated Marie Yovanovitch with kid gloves on Friday. I think the Republicans are walking a fine line. They've got to be sure they don't alienate their base. Their base is pro-military, pro-veterans. I think that they've got to be careful. I mean, that's not saying that they will, but both Democrats and Republicans, to my mind, are playing to their basis through this entire thing, as well as playing to the basis of the opposite party, right? We talked a little bit about this previously. Depending on how long this stretches out or how long they can stretch this out, this could very well impact public opinion around the March primaries and even the 2020 November elections. And so people, to my mind, are gathering votes. I have said this before. I highly doubt that we'll get to a place where the Senate actually impeaches the president.
Convicts
the president. And so what both sides are going to be left with at the end of this, in terms of who, and I'm using air quotes here, wins, is who has the best messaging, who was able to captivate their audience more, and who was able to convince their base and the base of even the opposing party, because either side will need to pull votes to win the 2020 elections, that they were acting righteously and not just doing political shenanigans for the sake of doing political shenanigans.
So I think, going back to Alexander Vindman, and again, once this hearing begins in Washington, D.C., it's now 8 minutes after, so they're starting a little bit late. They're going to make a long day even longer by starting late this way. Adam Schiff has
Chairman.
Just... gaveled in the hearing, and we now go to the House Intelligence Committee hearing. This is Adam Schiff. Well, Adam Schiff is speaking right now. As soon as we get that audio situation dealt with, we will go right to the hearing. He's giving his opening statement, so we'll get to this in just a moment. Alexander Vindman, Kat, is somebody who is probably in his closed deposition, has given the strongest testimony about his objection to what he was witnessing happening with Ukraine, and that might be the reason why the Republicans will feel it necessary to try to undercut Alexander Vindman. I agree with you entirely, actually, it's a perilous path that the Republicans have to take in going after him, because he will be in his uniform. I think we do have the issue resolved. We now go to the House Intelligence Committee. Adam Schiff.
Experienced diplomats who testified about President Trump's scheme to condition official acts, a White House meeting, and hundreds of millions of dollars of U.S. military aid to fight the Russians on a deliverable by the new Ukrainian President Zelensky two politically motivated investigations that Trump believed would help his reelection campaign. One of those investigations involved the Bidens, and the other involved a discredited conspiracy theory that Ukraine and not Russia was responsible for interfering in our 2016 election. As Ambassador Sondland would later tell career Foreign Service Officer David Holmes immediately after speaking to the president, Trump did not give a, he then used an expletive, about Ukraine. He cares about big stuff that benefits the president, like the Biden investigation that Giuliani was pushing. To press a foreign leader to announce an investigation into his political rival, President Trump put his own personal and political interests above those of the nation. He undermined our military and diplomatic support for a key ally and undercut U.S. anti-corruption efforts in Ukraine. How could our diplomats urge Ukraine to refrain from political investigations of its own citizens if the President of the United States was urging Ukraine to engage in precisely the same kind of corrupt and political investigations of one of our own citizens? At the White House, career professionals became concerned that President Trump, through an irregular channel that involved his acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland, and Rudy Giuliani, was pushing a policy towards Ukraine at odds with the national interest. This morning, we hear from two of the national security professionals who became aware of those efforts. Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vindman, whose family fled oppression in the Soviet Union when he was a toddler, is a career Army officer, an Iraq War veteran who was awarded a Purple Heart, and an expert in Russia and Ukraine who has worked at the highest levels of the Pentagon. In July 2018, he was detailed to the White House in part to coordinate policy on Ukraine. Jennifer Williams is a career Foreign Service officer who is currently detailed to the Office of the Vice President and responsible for Europe and Eurasia-related issues. Following his initial and congratulatory phone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky on April 21st, President Trump asked Vice President Pence to represent him at Zelensky's upcoming inauguration. Ms. Williams was working on logistics for the trip. Pence would be a coveted attendee, second in significance only to the president, and would have sent an important signal of support to the new Ukrainian president. In early May, however, Rudy Giuliani had been planning to go to Ukraine to pursue the president's interest in having the Bidens investigated, but had to call off the trip after it became public. Among others, Giuliani blamed people around Zelensky for having to cancel and claimed that they were antagonistic to Trump. 3 days later, the president called off the vice president's attendance at Zelensky's inauguration. Instead, a lower-level delegation was named, Energy Secretary Rick Perry, Ambassador Sondland, and Ambassador Kurt Volker, the three amigos. Senator Ron Johnson and Lieutenant Colonel Vindman would also attend. After returning from the inauguration, several members of the delegation briefed President Trump on their encouraging first interactions with Zelensky. They urged Trump to meet with the Ukrainian president, but Trump instead criticized Ukraine and instructed them to work with Rudy. A few weeks later, on July 10th, Ambassador Sondland met at the White House with a group of U.S. and Ukrainian officials, including Colonel Vindman, and informed the group that according to Chief of Staff Mulvaney, the White House meeting sought by the Ukrainian president with Trump would happen if Ukraine undertook certain investigations. National Security Advisor Bolton abruptly ended the meeting and said afterwards that he would not be part of whatever drug deal Sondland and Mulvaney are cooking up on this. Undeterred, Sondland brought the Ukrainian delegation downstairs to another part of the White House and was more explicit, according to witnesses. Ukraine needed to investigate the Bidens or Burisma if they were to get a White House meeting with Trump. After this discussion, which Vindman witnessed, he went to the National Security Council's top lawyer to report the matter. Vindman was told to return in the future with any concerns. He would soon find the need to do so. A week later, on July 18th, the representative of the Office of Management and Budget announced on a video conference call that Mulvaney, at Trump's direction, was freezing nearly $400 million in military assistance to Ukraine, which was appropriated by Congress and enjoyed the support of the entirety of the U.S. national security establishment. And 1 week after that, Trump would have the now infamous July 25th phone call with Zelensky. During that call, Trump complained that the U.S. relationship with Ukraine had not been reciprocal. Later, Zelensky thanks Trump for his support in the area of defense and says that Ukraine was ready to purchase more javelins, an anti-tank weapon that was among the most important deterrents of further Russian military action. Trump's immediate response, "I would like you to do us a favor, though." Trump then requested that Zelensky investigate the discredited 2016 conspiracy theory, and even more ominously, look into the Bidens. Neither was part of the official preparatory material for the call, but they were in Donald Trump's personal interest and in the interests of his 2020 re-election campaign. And the Ukrainian president knew about both in advance, because Sondland and others had been pressing Ukraine for weeks about investigations into the 2016 election, Burisma, and the Bidens. Both Colonel Vindman and Ms. Williams were on the July 25th call. Vindman testified that due to the unequal bargaining position of the two leaders and Ukraine's dependency on the U.S., the favor Trump asked of Zelensky was really a demand. After the call, multiple individuals, including Vindman, were concerned enough to report it to the National Security Council's top lawyer. It was the second time in 2 weeks that Vindman had raised concerns with NSC lawyers. For her part, Williams also believed that asking Zelensky to undertake these political investigations was inappropriate, and that it might explain something else that she'd become aware of, the otherwise inexplicable hold on U.S. military assistance to Ukraine. Both Colonel Vindman and Ms. Williams also took note of the explicit use of the word Burisma by Zelensky, a fact conspicuously left out of the record of the call, now locked away on an ultra-secure server. Colonel Vindman believed that Zelensky must have been prepped for the call to be able to make the connection between Biden and Burisma, a fact that other witnesses have now confirmed. In the weeks that followed the July 25th call, Colonel Vindman continued to push for a release of the military aid to Ukraine and struggled to learn why it was being withheld. More disturbing, word of the hold had reached Ukrainian officials prior to its becoming public. By mid-August, the Ukrainian deputy ambassador asked Vindman why the United States was withholding the aid. Although Vindman didn't have an answer, Sondland made it explicit to Ukrainians at a meeting in Warsaw. They needed to publicly commit to these two investigations if they hoped to get the aid. Ms. Williams, we all saw the president's tweet about you on Sunday afternoon and the insults he hurled at Ambassador Yovanovitch last Friday. You are here today, and the American people are grateful. Colonel Vindman, we have seen far more scurrilous attacks on your character and watched as certain personalities on Fox have questioned your loyalty. I note that you have shed blood for America, and we owe you an immense debt of gratitude. I hope no one on this committee will become part of those vicious attacks. Today's witnesses, like those who testified last week, are here because they were subpoenaed to appear, not because they are for or against impeachment. That question is for Congress, not the fact witnesses. If the president abused his power and invited foreign interference in our elections, if he sought to condition, coerce, extort, or bribe an ally into conducting investigations to aid his reelection campaign and did so by withholding official acts, a White House meeting, or hundreds of millions of dollars of needed military aid, it will be up to us to decide whether those acts are compatible with the office of the presidency. I now recognize Ranking Member Nunes for any remarks he'd like to make.
Thank you, gentlemen. I'd like to address
Republican Ranking Member
if you watched
Devin
the impeachment
Nunes,
hearings
California.
Last week, you may have noticed a disconnect between what you actually saw and the mainstream media accounts describing it. When you saw three diplomats who dislike President Trump's Ukraine policy discussing second-hand and third-hand conversations about their objections with the Trump policy. Meanwhile, they admitted they had not talked to the president about these matters, and they were unable to identify any crime or impeachable offense the president committed. But what you read in the press were accounts of shocking, damning, and explosive testimony that fully supports the Democrats' accusations. If these accounts have a familiar ring, it's because this is the same preposterous reporting the media offered for 3 years on the Russian hoax. On a nearly daily basis, the top news outlets in America reported breathlessly on the newest bombshell revelations showing that President Trump and everyone surrounding him were Russian agents. It really wasn't long ago that we were reading these headlines. From CNN, Congress investigating Russian investment fund with ties to Trump officials. This was false. New York Times, Trump campaign aides had repeated contacts with Russian intelligence. Also false. Slate, was a Trump server communicating with Russia. This was false. New York Magazine, will Trump be meeting with his counterpart or his handler? This was false. The Guardian, Manafort held secret talks with Assange and Ecuadorian embassy. Also false. BuzzFeed, President Trump directed his attorney to lie to Congress about the Moscow Tower project. All of these were false. There was no objectivity or fairness in the media's Russia stories, just as a fevered rush to tarnish and remove a president who refuses to pretend that the media are something different from what they really are, puppets of the Democratic Party. With their biased misreporting on the Russia hoax, the media lost confidence of millions of Americans, and because they refuse to acknowledge how badly they botched the story, they've learned no lessons and simply expect Americans will believe them as they try to stoke yet another partisan frenzy. In previous hearings, I've outlined three questions the Democrats and the media don't want asked or answered. Instead of shedding light on these crucial questions, the media are trying to smother and dismiss them. Those questions start with, what is the full extent of the Democrats' prior coordination with the whistleblower, and who else did the whistleblower coordinate this effort with? The media have fully accepted the Democrats' stunning reversal on the need for the whistleblower to testify to this committee. When the Democrats were insisting on his testimony, the media wanted it too. But things have changed since it became clear the whistleblower would have to answer problematic questions that include these. What was the full extent of the whistleblower's prior coordination with Chairman Schiff, his staff, and any other people he cooperated with while preparing the complaint? What are the whistleblower's political biases and connections to Democratic politicians? How does the whistleblower explain the inaccuracies in the complaint? What contact did the whistleblower have with the media, which appears to be ongoing? What are the sources of the whistleblower's information? Who else did he talk to? And was the whistleblower prohibited by law from receiving or conveying any of that information? The media have joined the Democrats in dismissing the importance of cross-examining this crucial witness. Now that the whistleblower has successfully kick-started impeachment, he has disappeared from the story, as if the Democrats put the whistleblower in their own witness protection program. My second question, what was the full extent of Ukraine's election meddling against the Trump campaign? In these depositions and hearings, Republicans have cited numerous indications of Ukraine meddling in the 2016 elections to oppose the Trump campaign. Many of these instances were reported, including the posting of many primary source documents by veteran investigative journalist John Solomon. Since the Democrats switched from Russia to Ukraine for their impeachment crusade, Solomon's reporting on Burisma, Hunter Biden, and Ukraine election meddling has become inconvenient for the Democratic narrative, and so the media is furiously smearing and libeling Solomon. In fact, the publication The Hill told its staff yesterday it would conduct a review of Solomon's Ukraine reporting. Coincidentally, the decision comes just 3 days after a Democrat on this committee told a Hill writer that she would stop speaking to The Hill because it had run Solomon's stories. And she urged the writer to relay her concerns to Hill's management. So now that Solomon's reporting is a problem for the Democrats, it's a problem for the media as well. I'd like to submit for the record John Solomon's October 31st story entitled Debunking Some of Ukraine's Scandal Myths About Biden and election interference. I encourage viewers today to read this story and draw your own conclusions about the evidence Solomon has gathered. Ask unanimous consent that we put this into the record, Mr. Chair.
Without objection.
The concerted campaign by the media to discredit and disown some of their own colleagues is shocking. And we see it again in the sudden denunciations of New York Times reporter Ken Vogel as a conspiracy theorist after he covered similar issues, including a 2017 Politico piece entitled "Ukrainian Efforts to Sabotage Trump Backfire." My third question, why did Burisma hire Hunter Biden? What did he do for them? And did his position affect any U.S. government actions under the Obama administration? We have now heard testimony from the Democrats' own witnesses that diplomats were concerned about a conflict of interest involving Hunter Biden. That's because he had secured a well-paid position despite having no qualifications on the board of a corrupt Ukrainian company, while his father was vice president charged with overseeing Ukrainian issues. After trying out several different accusations against President Trump, the Democrats have recently settled on bribery. According to widespread reports, they replaced their quid pro quo allegation because it wasn't polling well. But if the Democrats and the media are suddenly so deeply concerned about bribery, you would think they would take some interest in Burisma paying Hunter Biden $83,000 a month. And you think they would be interested in Joe Biden threatening to withhold U.S. loan guarantees unless the Ukrainians fired a prosecutor who was investigating Burisma. That would be a textbook example of bribery. The media, of course, are free to act as Democrat puppets, and they're free to lurch from the Russia hoax to the Ukraine hoax at the direction of their puppet masters. But they cannot reasonably expect to do so without alienating half the country who voted for the president they're trying to expel. Americans have learned to recognize fake news when they see it, and if the mainstream press won't give it to them straight, they'll go elsewhere to find it, which is exactly what the American people are doing. That I yield back.
I thank the gentleman. Today we are joined
Chairman
by Lieutenant Adam Colonel Schiff Vindman and Jennifer Williams.
To swear in the
Lieutenant Colonel
for
Alex
today.
Alexander Vindman is an active duty military officer who joined the Army after college and served multiple tours overseas, serving in South Korea, Germany, and Iraq. He was deployed to Iraq at a time of heavy fighting and was awarded a Purple Heart after being wounded by a roadside bomb. Since 2008, Colonel Vindman has served as a foreign area officer specializing in Eurasia, serving both at home and in U.S. embassies in Ukraine and Russia. He has served as a politico-military affairs officer for Russia for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He joined the Trump administration in July 2018 when he was asked to serve on the National Security Council. Jennifer Williams began her career in government service in 2005. Shortly after graduating from college, when she joined the Department of Homeland Security as a political appointee during the George W. Bush administration, and after working as a field representative on the 2004 Bush-Cheney presidential campaign. She joined the Foreign Service the following year, completing tours in Jamaica, Beirut, and Lebanon. Prior to joining the office of the Vice President, she served at the U.S. Embassy in London as a public affairs officer. In April 2019, Ms. Williams was detailed to the office of the Vice President, Mike Pence, where she serves as a special advisor on his foreign policy team covering Europe and Russia issues. In that capacity, she keeps the Vice President aware of foreign policy issues in Europe and Russia and prepares him for foreign policy engagements and meetings with foreign leaders. Two final points before our witnesses are sworn. First witness depositions as part of this inquiry were unclassified in nature, and all open hearings will also be held at the unclassified level. Any information that may touch on classified information will be addressed separately. Second, Congress will not tolerate any reprisal, threat of reprisal, or attempt to retaliate against any U.S. government official for testifying before Congress, including you or any of your colleagues. If you would both please rise and raise your right hand, I will begin by swearing you in. Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Let the record show the witnesses have answered in the affirmative. Thank you, and you may be seated. The microphones are sensitive, so please speak directly into them. Without objection, your written statement will be made part of the record. With that, Ms. Williams, you are now recognized for your opening statement. And when you are concluded, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, you are recognized immediately thereafter for your opening statement. Ms. Williams.
Thank you, Chairman Schiff.
Jennifer Williams, aide to Vice President Mike Pence.
Committee for the opportunity to provide this statement. I appear today pursuant to a subpoena and am prepared to answer your questions to the best of my abilities. I have had the privilege of working as a Foreign Service officer for nearly 14 years, working for three different presidential administrations, two Republican and one Democratic. I joined the State Department in 2006 after serving in the Department of Homeland Security under Secretary Michael Chertoff. It was with great pride and conviction that I swore an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution, administered by a personal hero of mine, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. As a career officer, I am committed to serving the American people and advancing American interests abroad in support of the President's foreign policy objectives. I have been inspired and encouraged in that journey by the thousands of other dedicated public servants who I'm proud to call colleagues across the Foreign Service, Civil Service, military, and federal law enforcement agencies. I have served overseas tours in Kingston, Jamaica, Beirut, Lebanon, and London, United Kingdom. I have worked to implement humanitarian assistance programs to serve millions of victims of the Syria conflict and served as an advisor on Middle East issues to the Deputy Secretary of State. And this spring, it was the greatest honor of my career to be asked to serve as a special advisor to the Vice President for Europe and Russia. Over the past 8 months, I have been privileged to work with the dedicated and capable men and women of the Office of the Vice President to advance the administration's agenda. I have also worked closely with talented and committed colleagues at the National Security Council, State Department, Department of Defense, and other agencies to advance and promote U.S. foreign policy objectives. In this capacity, I have advised and prepared the Vice President for engagements related to Ukraine. As you are aware, on November 7th, I appeared before the committee for a closed-door deposition pursuant to a subpoena. I would like to take this opportunity to briefly summarize my recollection of some of the events I expect the committee may ask me about. On April 21st, Volodymyr Zelensky won the Ukrainian presidential election. On April 23rd, the Vice President called to congratulate President-elect Zelensky. During the call, which I participated in, the Vice President accepted an invitation to attend President-elect Zelensky's upcoming inauguration, providing that the scheduling worked out. The Vice President had only a narrow window of availability at the end of May, and the Ukrainian Parliament would not meet to set a date for the inauguration until after May 14th. As a result, we did not expect to know whether the Vice President could attend until May 14th at the earliest, and we made only preliminary trip preparations in early May. On May 13th, an assistant to the Vice President's Chief of Staff called and informed me that President Trump had decided that the Vice President would not attend the inauguration in Ukraine. She did not provide any further explanation. I relayed that instruction to others involved in planning the potential trip. I also informed the NSC that the Vice President would not be attending so that it could identify a head of delegation to represent the United States at President-elect Zelensky's inauguration. On July 3rd, I learned that the Office of Management and Budget had placed a hold on a tranche of security assistance designated for Ukraine. According to the information I received, OMB was reviewing whether the funding was aligned with the administration's priorities. I subsequently attended meetings of the Policy Coordination Committee, where the hold on Ukrainian security assistance was discussed. During those meetings, representatives of the State and Defense Departments advocated that the hold should be lifted, and OMB representatives reported that the White House Chief of Staff had directed that the hold should remain in place. On September 11th, I learned that the hold on security assistance for Ukraine had been released. I have never learned what prompted that decision. On July 25th, along with several of my colleagues, I listened to a call between President Trump and President Zelensky, the content of which has since been publicly reported. Prior to July 25th, I had participated in roughly a dozen other presidential phone calls. During my closed-door deposition, members of the committee asked about my personal views and whether I had any concerns about the July 25th call. As I testified then, I found the July 25th phone call unusual because, in contrast to other presidential calls I had observed, it involved discussion of what appeared to be a domestic political matter. After the July 25th call, I provided an update in the Vice President's daily briefing book, indicating that President Trump had a call that day with President Zelensky. A hard copy of the memorandum transcribing the call was also included in the book. I do not know whether the Vice President reviewed my update or the transcript. I did not discuss the July 25th call with the Vice President or any of my colleagues in the Office of the Vice President or the NSC. On August 29th, I learned that the Vice President would be traveling to Poland to meet with President Zelensky on September 1st. At the September 1st meeting, which I attended, President Zelensky asked the Vice President about news articles reporting a hold on U.S. security assistance for Ukraine. The Vice President responded that Ukraine had the United States' unwavering support and promised to relay their conversation to President Trump that night. During the September 1st meeting, neither the Vice President nor President Zelensky mentioned the specific investigations discussed during the July 25th phone call. Thank you again for the opportunity to provide this statement. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman,
Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, top Ukraine expert for the National Security Council.
Respective activities relating to Ukraine and my role in the events under investigation. I've dedicated my entire professional life to the United States of America. For more than two decades, it has been my honor to serve as an officer in the United States Army. As an infantry officer, I served multiple overseas tours, including South Korea and Germany, and I was deployed to Iraq for combat operations. Since 2008, I have been a foreign area officer specializing in European and Eurasian political and military affairs. I served in the United States embassies in Kyiv, Ukraine, and Moscow, Russia. In Washington, D.C., I was the political and military affairs officer for Russia for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, where I drafted the Armed Forces Global Campaign Plan to counter Russian aggression and Russian malign influence. In July 2018, I was asked to serve at the White House National Security Council. At the NSC, I'm the principal advisor to the National Security Advisor on Ukraine and other countries in my portfolio. My role at the NSC is to develop, coordinate, and implement plans and policies to manage the full range of diplomatic, informational, military, and economic national security issues for the countries in my portfolio. My core function is to coordinate policy with departments and agencies. The committee has heard from many of my colleagues about the strategic importance of Ukraine as a bulwark against Russian aggression. It is important to note that our country's policy of supporting Ukrainian sovereignty and territorial integrity, promoting Ukrainian prosperity, and strengthening a free and democratic Ukraine as a counter to Russian aggression has been a consistent bipartisan foreign policy objective and strategy across various administrations, both Democratic and Republican, and that President Zelensky's election in April 2019 created an unprecedented opportunity to realize our strategic objectives. In the spring of 2019, I became aware of two disruptive actors, primarily Ukraine's then-prosecutor Yuri Lutsenko and former Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, President's personal attorney, promoting false narratives that undermined the United States-Ukraine policy. The NSC and its interagency partners, including the State Department, grew increasingly concerned about the impact that such information was having on our country's ability to achieve our national security objectives. On April 21, 2019, Volodymyr Zelensky was elected President of Ukraine in a landslide victory on a unity, reform, and anti-corruption platform. President Trump called President Zelensky on April 21, 2019 to congratulate him on his victory. I was the staff officer who produced the call materials and was one of the staff officers who listened to the call. The call was positive, and President Trump expressed his desire to work with President Zelensky and extended an invitation to visit the White House. In May, I attended the inauguration of President Zelensky as part of the presidential delegation led by Secretary Perry. Following the visit, the members of the delegation provided President Trump a debriefing offering a positive assessment of President Zelensky and his team. After this debriefing, President Trump signed a congratulatory letter to President Zelensky and extended another invitation to visit the White House. On July 10, 2019, Alexander Danyluk, then Ukraine's National Security Advisor, visited Washington, D.C. for a meeting with National Security Advisor Bolton. Ambassadors Volker and Sondland and Secretary Rick Perry also attended the meeting. I attended with Dr. Hill. We fully anticipated the Ukrainians would raise the issue of a meeting between the presidents. Ambassador Bolton cut the meeting short when Ambassador Sondland started to speak about the requirement that Ukraine deliver specific investigations in order to secure the meeting with President Trump. Following this meeting, there was a short debriefing during which Ambassador Sondland emphasized the importance of Ukraine delivering the investigations into the 2016 elections, the Bidens, and Burisma. I stated to Ambassador Sondland that this was inappropriate and had nothing to do with national security. Dr. Hill also asserted his comments when proper. Following the meeting, Dr. Hill and I agreed to report the incident to NSC's lead counsel, Mr. John Eisenberg. On July 21, 2019, President Zelensky won a parliamentary election in another landslide victory. The NSC proposed that President Trump call President Zelensky to congratulate him. On July 25, 2019, the call occurred. I listened on the call in the Situation Room with White House colleagues. I was concerned by the call. What I heard was inappropriate, and I reported my concerns to Mr. Eisenberg. It is improper for the President of the United States to demand a foreign government investigate a U.S. citizen and a political opponent. It was also clear that if Ukraine pursued an investigation into the 2016 elections, the Bidens and Burisma, it would be interpreted as a partisan play. This would undoubtedly result in Ukraine losing bipartisan support, undermining U.S. national security, and advancing Russia's strategic objectives in the region. I want to emphasize to the committee that when I reported my concerns on July 10th relating to Ambassador Sondland, and then July 25th relating to the President, I did so out of a sense of duty. I privately reported my concerns in official channels to the proper authority in the chain of command. My intent was to raise these concerns because they had significant national security implications for our country. I never thought that I'd be sitting here testifying in front of this committee and the American public about my actions. When I reported my concerns, my only thought was to act properly and to carry out my duty. Following each of my reports to Mr. Eisenberg, I immediately returned to work to advance the President's and our country's foreign policy objectives. I focused on what I have done throughout my military career, promoting America's national security interests. I want to take a moment to recognize the courage of my colleagues who have appeared and are scheduled to appear before this committee. I want to state that the character attacks on these distinguished and honorable public servants is reprehensible. It is natural to disagree and engage in spirited debate, and this has been the custom of our country since the time of our founding fathers, but we are better than personal attacks. The uniform I wear today is that of a United States Army, The members of our all-volunteer force are made up of a patchwork of people from all ethnicities, regions, socioeconomic backgrounds who come together under a common oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. We do not serve any political party, we serve the nation. I am humbled to come before you today as one of many who serve in the most distinguished and able military in the world. The Army is the only profession I have ever known. As a young man, I decided I wanted to spend my life serving this nation and gave my family refuge from authoritarian oppression. For the last 20 years, it has been an honor to represent and protect this great country. Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself, and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I also recognize that my simple act of appearing here today, just like the courage of my colleagues who have also truthfully testified before this committee, would not be tolerated in many places around the world. In Russia, my act of expressing concern to the chain of command in an official and private channel would have severe personal and professional repercussions, and offering public testimony involving the president would surely cost me my life. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you, Colonel. Thank you, Ms. Williams.
Democratic Chairman Adam Schiff.
Are more than welcome here. We're grateful to have them with us. We will proceed to the first round of questions as detailed in the memo provided to committee members. There will be 45 minutes of questions conducted by the chairman or majority counsel, followed by 45 minutes for the ranking member or minority counsel. Under House Resolution 660, that time may not be delegated to other members. Following that, unless I specify an additional equal time for extended questioning, we will proceed under the five-minute rule, and every member will have a chance to ask questions. I now recognize myself or majority counsel for the first 45 minutes. Before we get into the substance of your testimony, Ms. Williams, I want to ask you about a phone call between Vice President Pence and President Zelensky of Ukraine on September 18th. Were you on that call?
I was.
And did you take notes of the call?
Yes, sir.
Is there something about that call that you think may be relevant to our investigation?
Mr. Chairman, as we previously discussed with the committee, the Office of the Vice President has taken the position that the September...
Could you move the microphone
closer to you? Legal support for Ms. Williams.
As we've previously discussed with both majority and minority staff of the committee, the Office of the Vice President has taken the position that the September 18th call is classified. As a result, with respect to the call, I'd refer the committee to the public record, which includes Ms. Williams' November 7th testimony, which has been publicly released, as well as the public readout of that call, which has previously been issued by the White House. Beyond that, given the position of the Vice President's office on classification, I've advised Ms. Williams not to answer further questions about that call in an unclassified setting.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Williams, I would only ask you in this setting whether you think there's something relevant to our inquiry in that call, and whether, if so, you'll be willing to make a classified submission to the committee.
I would also refer to my testimony that I gave in the closed session, and I'm very happy to appear for a classified setting discussion as well.
It may not be necessary for you to appear if you'll be willing to submit the information in writing to the committee.
I'd be happy to do so.
I thank you. Colonel Vindman, if I could turn your attention to the April 21st call, that is the first call between President Trump and President Zelensky. Did you prepare talking points for the president to use during that call?
Yes, I did.
And did those talking points include rooting out corruption in Ukraine?
Yes.
That was something the president was supposed to raise in the conversation with President Zelensky?
Those were the recommended talking points that were cleared through the NSC staff for the president, yes.
Did you listen in on that call?
Yes, I did.
The White House has now released the record of that call. Did President Trump ever mention corruption in the April 21st call?
To the best of my recollection, he did not.
On the April 21st call, President Trump told President Zelensky that he would send a high-level U.S. delegation to the inauguration. Following that call, Ms. Williams, was your understanding that the President wanted the Vice President to attend the inauguration in Kyiv?
Yes, that was my understanding.
And did the President subsequently tell the Vice President not to attend the inauguration?
I was informed by our Chief of Staff's office, by the Vice President's Chief of Staff's office, that the President had told the Vice President not to attend. I did not witness that conversation.
And am I correct that you learned this on May 13th? Is that right?
That's correct.
Am I also correct that the inauguration date had not been set by May 13th?
That's correct.
Do you know what accounted for the President's decision to instruct the Vice President not to attend?
I do not.
Colonel Vindman, you were a member of the U.S. delegation to the inauguration on May 20th. Is that correct?
Yes, Chairman.
And during that trip, did you have an opportunity to offer any advice to President Zelensky?
Yes, Chairman.
What was the advice that you gave him?
During a bilateral meeting in which the whole delegation was meeting with President Zelensky and his team, I offered two pieces of advice, to be particularly cautious with regards to Ukraine, to be particularly cautious with regards to Russia, and its desire to provoke Ukraine, and the second one was to stay out of U.S. domestic policy.
You mean politics?
Politics, correct.
And why did you feel it was necessary to advise President Zelensky to stay away from U.S. Domestic politics?
Chairman, in the March and April timeframe, it became clear that there were actors in the U.S., public actors, non-governmental actors, that were promoting the idea of investigations and 2016 Ukrainian interference, and it was consistent with U.S. policy to advise any country, all the countries in my portfolio, any country in the world, to not participate in U.S. domestic politics. So I was passing the same advice consistent with U.S. policy.
I know Mr. Goldman will have more questions about that when I turn to him. But let me turn, if I can, to the hold on security assistance, which I think you both testified you learned about in early July. Am I correct that neither of you were provided with a reason for why the President put a hold on security assistance to Ukraine?
My understanding was that OMB was reviewing the assistance to ensure it was in line with administration priorities, but it was not made more specific than that.
And Colonel Vindman?
That is consistent. The review was to ensure it remained consistent with administration policies.
Colonel Vindman, you attended a meeting in John Bolton's office on July 10th where Ambassador Sondland interjected to respond to a question by senior Ukrainian officials about a White House visit. What did he say at that time?
To the best of my recollection, Ambassador Sondland said that in order to get a White House meeting, the Ukrainians would have to provide a deliverable, which is investigations, specific investigations.
And what was Ambassador Bolton's response or reaction to that comment?
We had not completed all of the agenda items, and we still had time for the meeting, and Ambassador Bolton abruptly ended the meeting.
Did you report this incident to the National Security Council lawyers?
Yes, I did.
Based on Ambassador Sondland's remark at the July 10th meeting, was it your clear understanding that the Ukrainians understood they had to commit to investigations President Trump wanted in order to get the White House meeting?
It may have not been entirely clear at that moment. Certainly Ambassador Sondland was calling for these meetings, and he had stated that this was developed per conversation with the Chief of Staff, Mr. Mick Mulvaney, but the connection to the President wasn't clear at that point.
But the import of what Ambassador Sondland said during that meeting was that there was an agreement with Mick Mulvaney that Zelensky would get the meeting if they would undertake these investigations.
That is correct.
About 2 weeks after that July 10th meeting, President Trump and President Zelensky had their second call, the now infamous July 25th call. Colonel Vindman, what was your real-time reaction to hearing that call?
Chairman, without hesitation, I knew that I had to report this to the White House counsel. I had concerns, and it was my duty to report my concerns to the proper people in the chain of command.
And what was your concern?
Well, Chairman, as I said in my statement, it was inappropriate, it was improper for the President to request and to demand an investigation into a political opponent, especially a foreign power where there's at best dubious belief that this would be a completely impartial investigation and that this would have significant implications if it became public knowledge and it would be perceived as a partisan play, it would undermine our Ukraine policy, and it would undermine our national security.
Now, Colonel, you've described this as a demand, this favor that the President asked. What is it about the relationship between the President of the United States and the President of Ukraine that leads you to conclude that when the President of the United States asks a favor like this, it's really a demand?
Chairman, the culture I come from, the military culture, when a senior asks you to do something, even if it's polite and pleasant, it's not to be taken as a request. It's to be taken as an order. In this case, the power disparity between the two leaders, my impression is that in order to get the White House meeting, President Zelensky would have to deliver these investigations.
Ms. Williams, I think you described your reaction in your deposition as when you listened to the call as you found it unusual and inappropriate. But I was struck by something else you said in your deposition. You said that it shed some light on possible other motivations behind a security assistance hold. What did you mean by that?
Mr. Chairman, I was asked during the closed-door testimony how I felt about the call. And in reflecting on what I was thinking in that moment, it was the first time I had heard internally the President reference particular investigations that previously I had only heard about through Mr. Giuliani's press interviews in press reporting. So in that moment, it was not clear whether there was a direct connection or linkage between the ongoing hold on security assistance and what the President may be asking President Zelensky to undertake in regard to investigations. So it was noteworthy in that regard. I did not have enough information to draw any firm conclusions.
But it raised a question in your mind as to whether the two were related.
It was the first I had heard of any requests of Ukraine which were that specific in nature. So it was noteworthy to me in that regard.
Both of you recall President Zelensky in that conversation raising the issue or mentioning Burisma, do you not?
That's correct.
Correct.
And yet the word Burisma appears nowhere in the call record that's been released to the public. Is that right?
That's right.
Correct.
Do you know why that's the case? Why that was left out?
I do not. I was not involved in the production of that transcript.
I attribute that to the fact that this transcript that is being produced may have not caught the word Burisma, and it was in the transcript that was released. It was released as the company, which is accurate. It's not a significant omission.
But Colonel, you pointed out the fact that that word was used. Did you not?
Correct.
And yet it was not included in the record release to the public.
That's right. It's I'd say it's informed speculation that the folks that produce these transcripts do the best they can, and they just didn't catch the word. And that was my responsibility to then make sure that the transcript was as accurate as possible. And that's what I attempted to do by putting that word back in because that was in my notes.
I think, Colonel, you testified in your deposition that you found it striking that Zelensky would bring up Burisma, that it indicated to you that he had been prepped for the call to expect this issue to come up. What led you to that conclusion?
It seemed unlikely that he would be familiar with a single company in the context of a call that was on the broader bilateral relationship. It seemed to me that he was either tracking this issue because it was in the press or he was otherwise prepped.
Mr. Goldman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Daniel Goldman, counsel for the Democrats.
On July 25th at approximately 9 a.m., you both were sitting in the Situation Room, probably not too much further away than you are right now. And you were preparing for a long-awaited phone call between President Trump and President Zelensky. Now, Colonel Vindman, in advance of this phone call, did you prepare talking points as you did for the April 21st call?
Yes, I did.
What were those talking points based upon?
So this is not in the public record, and I can't comment too deeply, but what is the areas that we've consistently talked about in public is cooperation on supporting his reform agenda, anti-corruption efforts, and helping President Zelensky implement his plans to end Russia's war against Ukraine.
In other words, they're based on official U.S. policy?
Correct.
And is there a process to determine official U.S. policy?
Yes, that is my job, is to coordinate U.S. policy. So throughout the preceding year that I've been on staff, I had undertaken an effort to make sure we had a cohesive, coherent U.S. policy.
And as you listened to the call, did you observe whether President Trump was following the talking points based on the official U.S. policy?
Counsel, the president could choose to use the talking points or not. He's the president, but they were not consistent with what I provided, yes.
Let's take a look at a couple of excerpts from this call. And right after President Zelensky thanked President Trump for the United States' support in the area of defense, President Trump asks President Zelensky for a favor and then raises this theory of Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election. He says in the highlighted portion, "I would like you to do us a favor, though, because our country has been through a lot and Ukraine knows a lot about it. I would like you to find out what happened with this whole situation with Ukraine. They say CrowdStrike. I guess you have one of your wealthy people, the server. They say Ukraine has it." Now, Colonel Vindman, was this statement based on the official talking points that you had prepared?
No.
And was this statement related to the 2016 Ukraine interference in the 2016 election part of the official U.S. policy?
No, it was not.
Now, at the time of this July 25th call, Colonel Vindman, were you aware of a theory that Ukraine had interfered in the 2016 U.S. election?
I was.
Are you aware of any credible evidence to support this theory?
I am not.
Are you also aware that Vladimir Putin had promoted this theory of Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election?
I am well aware of that fact.
And ultimately, which country did U.S. intelligence services determine to have interfered in the 2016 election?
It is the consensus of the entire intelligence community that the Russians interfered in U.S. elections in 2016.
Let's go to another excerpt from this call, where President Trump asked President Zelensky to investigate his political opponent, Vice President Joe Biden. Here, President Trump says, "The other thing, there's a lot of talk about Biden's son, that Biden stopped the prosecution, and a lot of people want to find out about that. So whatever you can do with the Attorney General would be great. Biden went around bragging that he stopped the prosecution, so if you can look into it." It sounds horrible to me, he said. Again, Colonel Vindman, was this included in your talking points?
It was not.
Is such a request to investigate a political opponent consistent
Hello,
with official U.S.
Leo,
policy?
You're listening to WGXC 90.7
It was not
FM
consistent
Ingra.
With the policy as I understood it.
Now, are you aware of any credible allegations or evidence to support this notion that Vice President Biden did something wrong or against U.S. policy with regard to Ukraine?
I am not.
Ms. Williams, are you familiar with any credible evidence to support this theory against Vice President Biden?
No, I'm not.
Now, Ms. Williams, prior to the July 25th call, approximately how many calls between President of the United States and foreign leaders had you listened to?
I would say roughly a dozen.
Had you ever heard a call like this?
As I testified before, I believe what I found unusual or different about this call was the President's reference to specific investigations, and that struck me as different than other calls I had listened to.
You testified that you thought it was political in nature. Why did you think that?
I thought that the references to specific individuals and investigations, such as former Vice President Biden and his son, struck me as political in nature, given that the former Vice President is a political opponent of the President.
And so you thought that it could potentially be designed to assist President Trump's reelection effort?
I can't speak to what the President's motivation was in referencing it, but I just noted that the reference to Biden sounded political to me.
Colonel Vindman, you said in your deposition that it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see the political benefits of the President's demands. For those of us who are not rocket scientists, can you explain what you meant by that?
So my understanding is that it was the connection to investigate into a political opponent was inappropriate and improper. I made that connection as soon as the President brought up the Biden investigation.
Colonel Vindman, you testified that the President Trump's request for a favor from President Zelensky would be considered as a demand to President Zelensky. After this call, did you ever hear from any Ukrainians, either in the United States or Ukraine, about any pressure that they felt to do these investigations that President Trump demanded?
Not that I can recall.
Did you have any discussions with officials at the embassy here, the Ukrainian embassy here in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, I did.
Did you discuss at all the demand for investigations with them?
I did not.
Did you discuss at all, at any point, their concerns about the hold on security assistance?
To the best of my recollection, in the August timeframe, the Ukrainian embassy started to become aware of the hold on security assistance, and they were asking if I had any comment on that or if I could substantiate that.
And that was before it went became public, is that right?
Yes.
And what did you respond?
I believe I said that I don't recall, frankly. I don't recall what I said, but I believe it may have been something along the lines of I'm not aware of it.
You testified that one of your concerns about the request for investigations related to U.S. domestic politics was that Ukraine may lose bipartisan support. Why was that a concern of yours?
Ukraine is in a war with Russia, and the security assistance that we provide Ukraine is significant. Absent that security assistance, and maybe even more importantly, the signal of support for Ukrainian sovereignty and territorial integrity that would likely encourage Russia to pursue, to potentially escalate, to pursue further aggression, further undermining Ukrainian sovereignty, European security, and U.S. security.
So in other words, Ukraine is heavily dependent on United States support, both diplomatically, financially, and also militarily?
Correct.
Colonel Vindman, what languages do you speak?
I speak Russian and Ukrainian and a little bit of English.
Do you recall what language President Zelensky spoke on this July 25th phone call?
I know he made a valiant effort to speak English. He'd been practicing up his English, but he also spoke Ukrainian.
I want to look at the third excerpt from the July 25th call. And Chairman